This is Seattle's Morning News. Dave Ross with Colleen O'Brien and Chris Sullivan. Oh, hearts are aflutter on Wall Street. Let's go to CBS senior business analyst Jill Schlesinger. Looks like investors are not too happy, at least for the start of the market. What's behind that?
You know, there's a few things. I just want to remind everybody that through Friday's close, all the three major U.S. indexes were within 3% of their all-time highs. The S&P 500 up 18% this year. So we're not looking at a situation where all of a sudden everything's going away. But a situation is brewing in China where a large real estate company called Evergrande is looking like it could be going broke. And there are some concerns that because this is a company that used a lot of borrowed money to expand, that it could kind of trickle into a lot of different parts of the Chinese economy. And that could mean that many companies that use borrowed money will be under pressure. And so there's a lot of selling going on in China. And I think that that has really caused some investors here in the U.S. And big hedge funds to say, well, we took all of these big bets on high flyers and risky assets. We are up 18% this year in the U.S. markets. Maybe it's time to lock in some gains and see what happens next. And so you get that kind of an event overseas, an exogenous event from far away that you can't anticipate. And all of a sudden, it causes many investors to say, wait a minute, what should I do now? Maybe I'll make some money and let's see what happens next.
Does this affect then stocks that are primarily for companies that are closely wrapped up in China?
Well, I think it could. I mean, I
know
think
Apple
that
is being hit by this.
Yeah, I mean, I think that the Chinese aspect of it is hard to predict because we don't know what the Chinese government's going to do. You know, in many past iterations of these kinds of situations, the Chinese government would step in and try to save a company. And I think that now they're really trying to show that they have a freer economy, that they will let forces work themselves out. And I think that this could spread to other Chinese companies and certainly could lead to a sell-off in China. But, you know, I think it's a bit overstated to start to extrapolate that this one company is the Lehman Brothers of 2021. And I think that that's what some people are talking about. I think that's a little dangerous. I mean, it could get there, I guess, but I think that if growth slows down in China because of the impact on the real estate sector, and we have and growth overall in a company like Apple is tied up in Chinese economic growth, then yeah, you're going to see some correlation, but I don't think it's hand in hand.
Is anybody worried about the prospect of a default here because we're getting close to, of course, the whole debt ceiling controversy again?
Not now. I think what's interesting is that, you know, there was an op-ed in this morning's Wall Street Journal by Janet Yellen saying, shockingly, hey, let's raise the debt ceiling. Everyone, yeah. This is not new spending. This is what has already been voted on. This has been agreed upon, right, that Congress said, we're going to spend this money. Now we're just paying for it. So the answer is, I think that it should be okay. But I when I say should and government and decisions, I often sort of hold my breath a little bit.
Yeah. Now, in your very fine weekly edition of Jill on Money, I saw you use the word stagflation, a word.
How do
you
feel about that?
Well, because it brings me back to the Carter years, which I realize for most people might as well be the Jurassic era. But those are really miserable economic times. I remember, you know, having to get a mortgage at a 15% interest rate. So I'd rather not go back to those days. So what are you worried about here?
Wait a minute, but you got a mortgage at 15%, but you made 18% on your CDs. So there
okay,
was that.
Okay, yes, that's true.
Okay, so stagflation, a stagnating economy plus high prices or inflation, and it's a terrible condition for any economy, and it was sort of like the sort of highlight of the 70s. This is a term that was coined in the mid-60s in the UK, and it was really starting to describe the situation after World War II. We had, you know, basically 20 years of massive growth in places like the UK and the United States, and then growth was slowing down. And as growth was slowing down, unfortunately, it occurred at this very moment in the early 70s where there was a war in the Middle East and there was an oil embargo, and then prices ballooned up. And so you had a stagnating economy with high prices, and it was very difficult to navigate out of that. And I was thinking about stagflation as the Federal Reserve begins a two-day meeting tomorrow and wondering, you know, gosh, they're dusting off their 70s whip inflation now pins and trying to figure out what to do next, because it's a difficult situation. It's a real bind for the Fed. On one hand, remember, what do they need to do? They need to have enough economic growth to get anyone who wants a job. Like, we just want to have that much growth. But on the other hand, you don't want too much growth to create inflation. Fed has already told us that they are willing to let prices run hotter than they normally would because of this strange pandemic response and supply chain issues. Then that's a problem still, because honestly, if people aren't getting enough of a wage increase to pay for the higher prices, the whole model falls apart. So feel bad for those Fed guys and gals.
Oh, I do every day.
I know you do.
CBS senior business analyst Jill Schlesinger. Thank you, Jill.
Take care.
Seattle's Morning News. This is Dave Ross with Colleen O'Brien and Chris Sullivan. To boost or not, let's call in the doctor.
Paging Dr. Cohen.
Dr. Gordon Cohen, MD. And Dr. Cohen, a group of FDA experts is recommending that the boosters be limited now to anybody 65 and over and to those who are considered to be at higher risk because of compromised immune systems. But the president wanted everybody to be eligible starting today. So is the FDA worried about something specific here?
Actually, I was really happy to see the outcome of the panel, because the FDA demonstrated that they are not politically motivated. What the panel found was, in short, that there wasn't enough data to actually justify giving the booster. When they looked at all the data that was present and they looked at the data that Pfizer presented, they found that the data just didn't support the necessity for a third shot. The panel actually voted 16-2 against it, but more importantly, they also took it a step further and they voted 18-0 in support of giving the vaccine to people who were 65 or older at high risk of severe COVID-19 infection, or for other people who had a high risk of occupational exposure, such as healthcare officials. So they were very thoughtful and decisive in their decision-making, and they didn't actually just cave in to the political desires to give a vaccine to everyone. And this is consistent with what I have been saying all along, and you and I have discussed repeatedly, which is that this is a public health issue and it's not a political issue, and the FDA treated it as such.
Now, there's going to be another meeting of experts, this time CDC experts, as opposed to the FDA experts. So do they have the power to overrule this?
So, Dave, I think this is a tricky question, and I'm not exactly sure I know the answer, but frankly, I'm not sure anyone knows the answer. In theory, the FDA has the ultimate say-so, and the CDC has to follow the FDA's recommendation, because ultimately it's the FDA that gives the approval for the use of a drug and not the CDC. The CDC, I believe, can only make recommendations to the FDA. But if we think back when President Trump was in office and Alex Azar was the head of the HHS, Health and Human Services, there was some discussion back then about the HHS overruling the FDA. So I'm not sure that this is entirely clear, and I think this is clearly going to be something that's to be debated. But my understanding is that ultimately it's the FDA who gives the approval for the drug, and the CDC can only make recommendations to the FDA as to what they think is necessary or not necessary. So I don't think Dr. Fauci will be ultimately overruling the FDA panel.
Now, I also read that there are some hospitals who have come out and said, well, we've got doses ready to go. So why couldn't they just go ahead and give the shots on their own?
So, Dave, here's the thing. Just because you have doses ready to go doesn't mean that it's the right thing to do. And that was the whole point of convening the FDA panel and for them to make a decision. And it goes back to something we've talked about on your show numerous times. Just because some is good doesn't mean that more is better. And that's exactly the question that the FDA was trying to address. Just because we have the vaccine and because we have it available, does giving more of the vaccine mean that it's going to be more effective than what we've given so far? And ultimately, what the science says, what the data says, is that we don't have enough data or evidence yet to say that it is necessary. So that's why the FDA came down with the recommendation that they did.
I also saw some statistics which indicated that there's a gap between the Pfizer and Moderna shots, with the Pfizer vaccine losing its effectiveness more quickly than Moderna. So is that significant? And could that mean that Pfizer people ought to get the vaccine first?
So it's a very interesting question, Dave, because a recent comparison of all three COVID vaccines actually found that the Moderna vaccine is holding up better than the Pfizer, and the Johnson & Johnson vaccine actually provides the weakest protection. But I think it's really important to note, and I think it's important for people to hear, that the research emphasized that all three vaccines are still providing strong protection against people getting so sick that they end up in the hospital. The investigators who looked at this looked at over 3,000 people who were hospitalized between March and August of this year, and they found that the Moderna vaccine was actually 93% effective at keeping people out of the hospital, and that protection appears to be holding steady. The Pfizer vaccine didn't fare quite as well. Their protection fell from 91% effective to 77% effective, and the Johnson & Johnson vaccine was 71% effective. There may be, and there's been a lot of discussion about this, because the Moderna vaccine was spaced out by 4 weeks, whereas the Pfizer vaccine was only spaced out by 3 weeks. And there has been some discussion that maybe we were giving the two vaccines too close together anyway, that they should have been spaced out by 2 months or even 3 months, that by giving them just 3 or even 4 weeks apart, they were so close together that it really was like giving a single dose. But the reasons for this aren't entirely clear. All we can look at is the statistical outcomes. Then it appears that the Moderna vaccine has a slightly better efficacy long-term than does the other two.
Dr. Gordon Cohen, MD. Dr. Cohen, thank you.
Thanks, Dave.
And come January, every person who lives in Washington and gets a W-2 will have a new deduction on their paycheck unless they opt out by November 1st. Chi Radio's Hannah Scott is here with what you need to know about the new WaCares program. Good morning, Hannah.
Good morning, Dave. Yep. The WaCares program will, again, start to be taken out of your check in January, and it's somewhat like the paid family leave that is deducted, except for this is paid for by employees only, so just you getting the W-2 form. And then also it is not your employers don't kick in, and it's a little bit higher than what you would pay in for the Family Leave Act, but it is not going to be as high as, say, your, you know, Social Security deduction, something like that. So it's a much lower than the Social Security deduction. It would be about 0.5% of every $100 that you earn, and everybody pays into it unless you can meet the opt-out deadline of buying your own private long-term insurance by November 1st. So there's been a bit of a rush on people trying to do that. And the issue is that most people, they say, are going to need some form of long-term care towards the latter part of their life. And almost none of us have been preparing for it. So Nicole Macri, a Democrat in the state legislature, she was the sponsor of this bill. And she says there's a couple of different things that this program offers when it's compared to, say, private insurance.
It's just a payroll deduction. So if you're working, you pay. If you're not working, you don't pay. So if you're unemployed for a period, if you're raising your kids and out of the workplace, you know, you don't pay. But if you pay in for 10 years over your working years, then you're eligible for the benefit, you know, and if you retire when you're 60 and you need long-term care when you're 85, you're eligible for that benefit, even if you hadn't, you know, obviously been working or paying for 25 years.
Now, on the flip side,
with long-term care in the commercial market, you have to pay the premiums until you die or until you draw down benefits. So many people are paying those premiums well past retirement.
And that can be a very large bill, and especially if you live longer, right? You're still paying all the way until you die. And she knows firsthand what it's like to go through this with her own mother.
We expended all of her savings. We took off huge amounts of time from work to care for her. And then ultimately we got her on Medicaid because she needed nursing home care. And then she passed away within a couple of months of being in the nursing home. And that's a common story.
And it is a common story. It's one that I went through myself. And what she's talking about is if you don't have the private care or the private insurance and you can't afford to go to a nursing home, in order to qualify for Medicaid, you have to make yourself poor. You have to get rid of everything. And they say that basically the argument is that people who need this kind of care, the lifetime benefit of this that you pay in is $36,500. And they say that most people on average are going to need about anywhere from a couple of months to maybe a couple of years of care. And that this is kind of meant to fill that gap where, so if you need someone to come in the home, so for instance, in Representative Macri's case, and in my case, when I was taking care of my own grandmother, we both took time off of work to be dedicated to taking care of that family member. Well, there was no pay for that. You know, you lose your own money and it has kind of this ripple effect in the economy. So this money, for instance, could be used to cover 4 hours a day of in-home care that can either go towards a private person that you bring in the home or can be paid to a relative who is staying home to care for that person for about a year is what they say that the 36.5 would go to. So that's one of the big benefits. And the other issue is that Medicaid, they say, will the need for it will increase dramatically as this need for long-term care happens. Because even as people do that spend down where you have to get rid of all of the things you own that really have any value and give that to the state for Medicaid, that's not enough. It's not going to be enough for what the ultimate cost is. So this is meant to kind of make that difference.
Now, did I hear you say there are certain vesting rules? You have to pay into it for a certain period of time?
You do have to pay into it for 10 years to get the full 36.5.
Okay, so suppose you're paying it into it for like 9.5 and then you retire.
Then they'll have a prorated system. I believe you have to have minimum, you have to pay in for 3 years is what that will look like. So the other important thing is that while you will start to pay into this in January of 2022, there will be no benefit available until 2025. So that's the full 3 years. So that's where you get that prorated kind of 3 years. You can start to access some of these dollars. And I believe it can be like $100 a day. So you can do it. You don't have to do it all at once. In other words, you can do it over time if maybe you need, because you can also use this for any time that you might need somebody to come in the home. Say you have some terrible accident, right? And you need in-home care. It can be accessed for those types of things as well. Now, the issues with Republicans, this is Senator Peter King, they have issues with the lifetime benefit because of the gap and the cost that they think that most people will need if they were to say go into a nursing home, which is a much higher rate. You need, you know, maybe anywhere from $5,000 a month to $10,000 a month to cover a nursing home. And the people behind this program say it was never really intended to do that. It's not meant to cover the full cost of a nursing home, though it could for a very short time. The other issues, though, that Republicans are raising are significant issues. Again, here's Senator King.
It's not portable. So if you leave the state, if you retire, and your kids say, hey, Mom, Dad, come live with us. We want you to be close so that we can help you as you age and you live in Iowa, you walk away from your, you know, something that you may have paid into all of your life. You just leave it. It's not portable. If you work in the state of Washington, but you live in Idaho, Oregon, Canada, you pay, but you're not eligible to receive the benefit. If you're an H-2A worker that comes into the state, they're going to take that money out of your check, but you'll never be eligible to receive the benefit.
So that all true. And that is one of the big pushbacks that you're hearing about this is that because it's going to be taken from everybody who doesn't have their own insurance and opt out by November 1st. So they are, I am told, the people who run the program are going to be looking at this over the next 3 years while we get to that 2025 part year where people can start receiving these benefits. There is discussions that are going to be had about how this can be made more fair, where perhaps there is a way to make it somehow portable for some of these situations. But at the same time, you cannot do that entirely and make it so everybody who leaves the state or everybody who lives out of state and works here is going to be eligible, because then you'd have to have a much higher pay in, basically. Yeah. Because
the other problem is that we found in our family that sometimes you cannot get long-term care insurance if you have a pre-existing condition. No problem.
Absolutely. They address that, too.
We'll give it to you. So ultimately, then, if somebody is uninsured and doesn't have a lot of money, they go on Medicaid, which means we pay anyway, right?
We pay anyway, and through regressive sales tax is what the lawmakers told me about this, and it's true. But so that's basically the disconnect, because there's a lot of noise about this right now, and the Democrats behind this, and the person who's running this program, this fund, says people don't really understand the Medicaid aspect of this, and that they're going to end up paying anyway, and that spend down, and I'll tell you, having been through that spend down, it's really.
You got to sell off the house.
You got to sell everything. It's a hard time. It is one of the worst experiences I've had in my lifetime, is trying to do this alone, take care of an aging relative as they go through dementia, as you have to sell off everything they care about and love. It is just an awful experience. And I don't know that everybody knows what that's like if you haven't gone through it. And that's what the people who support this will say.
Hannah Scott. Hannah, thanks very much.
You bet.
It's time for your daily dose of kindness now, brought to you by Robert W. Baird & Company, Incorporated. In a tiny Colorado town, a high school team was at risk of losing their season when rival teams refused to play on the worst football field in America. CBS's Steve Hartman has more.
250 miles south of Denver, near the edge of isolation, sits the tiny town of Branson, Colorado. Blink, and you'll moose it. But Branson does have a sight to see, what many have dubbed the worst football field in America.
No, I don't dispute that title.
Brad Doherty is the Branson High School athletic director and head dirt's keeper.
How bad can a football field be?
We would go out before every game and fill in and collapse as many gopher holes as we could find. It felt like Bill Murray in Caddyshack.
And the grass would stab you, the grass. Maybe you'd land in cactus if you were lucky.
But the Bearcats loved football enough to endure. Until the end of last season, when the other teams in the league said they wouldn't play on this rocky rectangle of high desert anymore. It was just too dangerous, they said.
It was pretty heart-wrenching to hear that people didn't want to come play on our field.
Football in our community is the one thing that grabs everybody and brings everybody together.
Which is why Brad decided to attempt a Hail Mary. Had the kids make a video explaining how they needed artificial turf because they didn't have enough water in Branson to grow real grass. And how the price shocked the school board.
We need your help.
Brad posted the plea on social media, hoping anyone outside Branson would see it.
You just do that for kids.
But this was a goal that was destined to fail.
Yeah, and that's why it was so amazing.
Thanks to the kindness of strangers from across the country, Branson's Bad News Bearcats are back in the ballgame. Ended up raising more than $500,000 and now have the best field in the league. They just had their first game and won by almost 60 points. But Brad says the bigger victory is the field itself.
It became something that we show our kids. You can aspire to do great and impossible things.
An oasis of inspiration for generations to come. Steve Hartman,
hey, good job,
CBS News,
good stuff.
On the road.
Good luck.
We have another proud football dad in the studio this morning, that being G. Scott, who is on the air at 9 o'clock right here on Cairo Radio. I saw the video of your son playing for Ohio State. Pretty impressive there.
Yeah. He got his first catch, and that was great. It was third down and 6, and he was called upon, and he had a 16-yard reception, and it was good. And so, you know, like we had discussed Saturday morning, both he and I, I say the same thing every time, is when your number is called, you just be ready. And I always have bored him with stories of the past and told him how Richard Sherman didn't play the first, second game, and then he didn't get a chance until the third game. And when his number was called, he was ready. And how I've seen so many football players, when their number's called, they just have to be ready. And so that was it. And so it was good for him. He was excited to go to practice yesterday. And it just kind of gives him, you know, something to look forward to. And it lets his coaches know that when his number's called, he's ready.
Congratulations.
I hear a deepness in both G and Sully's voice this weekend from all the football screaming and yelling. Yeah. Both of you guys are in the Dave Ross register this morning.
You know, check this out. I scream less during my own son's games.
Of course.
Than I do for Seahawks.
Well, you're focused.
Right? I don't know.
On your son?
There was a lot of screaming at Seahawks yesterday. So
yeah, I think it's a focus. You're right, Colleen. But the Seahawks, man. Everything was good until it wasn't.
Yeah.
And you're like, everybody's having a good time. I was at the stadium. I mean, I had an opportunity. I was with Michael Bennett and Doug Baldwin and raised a flag. And of course, he was Legend of the Year. And I mean, it was just, I thought, what a perfect, beautiful day in Seattle. I'm watching football with some of the greatest players to ever play for the Seahawks. Everything was great. And then all of a sudden, what happened? And here's what happened. What happened is, and I know offensively, you're like, oh, you know, all the passes were great. Tyler Lockett was great. He had 8 receptions for 178 yards. DK Metcalf was his normal self. Freddie Swain made an appearance. The Seahawks didn't run the ball that well. They rushed for under 100 yards, and they did not control the clock. And then you see what the Titans did in them running the ball, and that's what they did. They came back with their identity. They ran for 212 yards rushing. Derrick Henry ran for 182 yards, including that big 60-yarder towards the end of the game. That's what happened.
Yeah. Is there anything to worry about here from what you saw yesterday? Was this just a one-off?
You know, it was just a one-off. I mean, look, the Titans are a very good team. This is what we have been discussing. This was going to be a mad Titans team. They had already lost their first game of the season. They're coming into Lumen Field, and they're going to be ready to play. Here's my only concern. My only concern, not necessarily with the team, is it is so hard to get wins in the NFL. And if everybody was watching thinking – at one point, like, yes, the Seahawks are going to win this game. I kind of think everybody thought that. I think Pete Carroll thought that. I think the Seahawks thought that. I think the Seahawks, I mean, overwhelmingly so, were the better team yesterday. But what happened was they let the Titans hang in it for too long. And when you let a good team like the Titans hang in it for too long, that's what happens. So my only concern, Dave and Colleen, is – that's a win you got to have. And I hope that that's one of those ones that we're not talking about later on in the season. Like, I hope we can forget about this because the Seahawks start winning games and everything like that. And it's like, oh, yeah, okay, whatever. They lost that week two. It doesn't matter. That's my only concern.
I hope we continue to have a season because based on the TV broadcast, looks like a lot of unmasked or chin masked people out there.
They're vaccinated.
They're all vaccinated.
All right.
Vaccinated.
Yep. I thought it was outdoor events with 500 people or more. Doesn't matter. Your vaccines require, you know, all those rules. But looks like it wasn't
quite.
It's
all part of that big experiment we're all in, Colleen.
Colleen, real quick. What? You know what you reminded me of?
What?
It's like curfews at 10 o'clock. And I made it in the house at 9:58, and then my mom wakes me up and says, "But you didn't park the car in the driveway."
I'm being like a mega Karen watching CenturyLink.
Somebody's
right got
to play that role.
I'd like to speak to Lumen Field's manager. Nobody was wearing a mask. I'm going to film you and put it on social.
Getting that special. G. Scott and Ursula, 9 o'clock on Cairo Radio. Thank you, G. Seattle's Morning News. He was considered such a threat that he was committed as a sexually violent predator to McNeil Island. But last week, just days away from release, the Spokane area man was linked to yet another rape more than a decade ago. It was thanks to the state's push to process the backlog of untested sexual assault evidence. And Cairo Radio's Hannah Scott has the details. Hannah.
Yes, this is Scott Halverson is his name, and he's got a 40-year rap sheet. He was just about to be released from McNeil Island, as you said last week, when these efforts to test the backlog rape kits amongst multiple departments, the state crime lab, led to a hit, as we know it, it's called, in the CODA system. That's the criminal database of a 2004 cold case rape of a woman who was choked to unconsciousness and attacked in a park in Spokane. Now, they can't say much because this is all still going on right now, but investigators in Spokane tell KXLY that they hope that this leads to Halverson staying locked up.
I hope that this is actually taken to trial. The prosecutor's office is, it's now in their hands, and it's not really for me to say, but I think most of us can agree he's a very dangerous person, and I hope that ultimately that's the truth that comes out.
His prior crimes include the attack of a 4-year-old, a 10-year-old girl in their own house who was taken out of her home, kidnapped in the 80s, on top of other assaults against women. Now, they say a now-retired investigator from back in 2004 deserves a lot of the credit in this case.
She did a lot of follow-up on this on her own in the following days and weeks, and she stayed in contact with the victim. And ultimately, some of the things she found are going to prove to be very important in this case.
Now, again, this is all because of the rape kit backlog or the effort to test our rape kit backlog. State Attorney General Bob Ferguson says this is exactly what he had in mind when he helped give this. We recently did the story about the grant that he got from the Justice Department to help put money out to these departments to test all the backlogged rape kits. And that's what happened here.
All this hard work to eliminate this huge backlog of untested rape kits is starting to bear fruit and hopefully catch some bad guys and bring some accountability to the criminal justice system.
That money that we just reported on was the second grant that he got. It was about $3.5 million, I believe, going out again to these various departments. In Spokane, they had about 1,000 of the untested rape kits that they are trying to work through. Again, this is one of those.
So Spokane County, for example, where this individual is, had more than 1,000 untested kits. And so those have been submitted. About half of those have now been tested. And just recently, one of the tested kits turned out to be a match for this individual, Mr. Halverson. An untested rape kit recently was tested. And then when they submit that into a database, it turned out to be a hit for this individual who is about to be released into the public. And so now he's being held and being, and now the prosecutors go forward as appropriate with any charges they want to make.
And he was in court last week, and he will be in court again next week. So it remains to be seen exactly how this will play out. But the AG says, look, this is such a problem, and there's so many good examples out of this case.
Well, look, I mean, you don't end up on McNeil Island unless you are amongst the most serious sexual offenders in our state. Those are the folks who end up there. And this individual was literally days away from being released into the public. But fortunately, because we've started testing these untested rape kits that literally have been sitting on shelves for years across our state, that a test came back, a recent test came back as a match for this individual. And hopefully that will help to keep him behind bars.
Now, Ferguson says the update on the actual 10,000 backlog kits in our state is that they're about halfway through that process right now.
When you stop and think about it, it's outrageous that we could have thousands of these kits just sitting on shelves all across our state, not being tested. That's outrageous for the victim, and that's outrageous for accountability and keeping our community safe. And this is a perfect example, and this will not be the last time, Anna. There will be other examples like this in the months and years to come as these untested kits get tested, get put into the system, and then investigators can find matches to unsolved crimes.
As for the sexual assault case initiative that he is running throughout the state and giving this money, this grant money, to these different departments, being part of the ability to catch this guy, he couldn't be more thrilled.
You know, I know it's hard to believe probably for listeners, but in Washington State, we had a backlog of more than 10,000 untested rape kits. Where there's a
So he couldn't, again, be more thrilled to have this be a part of it. And this is a really, really good example. Not the first one we've had, actually, either. But I've never had one where it's somebody on McNeil Island. And this guy was scary, his rap sheet alone.
Yeah. So, in other words, if there was somebody who had been released, but if they later discover that he's linked to one of these previous cases, they can go back and rearrest him, correct?
Absolutely. Absolutely. And I know when we're talking about victims who are children, they have changed the state law so that there is no statute of limitations for sexual assault crimes against children. They've not yet been able to successfully do that for adults, but I believe if it's an untested kid, there is a special circumstance thing where you can do it a bit longer. And I know there's an ongoing effort to do away with the statute of limitations altogether. But yeah, absolutely. You can be charged for a cold case for something like this, and they can go back and get you.
Right. There it is, Hannah Scott. Hannah, thank you.
You bet.
American troops may have withdrawn from Afghanistan, but the feeling of loss remains for the family of American service members who died there. Cairo Radio's Heather Bosch talks about the local chapter of a charity that's been helping families heal for more than 90 years, the Gold Star Mothers of Washington.
In a video from Afghanistan,
I'm gonna beat his 12.
We're gonna beat his 12.
A young man jokes with fellow Marines.
Nice.
A precious memory for Monica McNeil of her son.
Eric is my only child. I do have two wonderful stepchildren, and Eric is a fourth generation Marine.
So adamant was he about joining the service that at 17 he asked his mom to sign the paperwork to join early.
And I did remind him that there was a war, and that's why he said he has to go. He said, no, I have to go now.
He enlisted, went to boot camp, and deployed to Afghanistan.
And then almost exactly 16 months later, he was killed.
One of more than 2,300 American servicemen and women to die in Afghanistan alone before the U.S. ended its 20-year fight August 31st.
But I'll never forget the night Eric was killed, and we sat around and talked, and I said, there's an Afghan mom who probably also lost her child tonight.
It was that pain that mothers know, which prompted moms back in the World War I era to gather for what would be the first meeting of the Gold Star Moms. In that group where they found comfort, many realized they had the same question too, not why, but how?
Now, how do you honor your child?
McNeil, who heads up the Washington State branch, says the group immediately became about service also. She says the moms take on projects that benefit veterans and active duty military.
It's a combination. It's really what's needed. So, let's say at Joint Base, we have supported Santa's Castle. So we bring in Christmas gifts for kids. We also do back-to-school supplies, so that's more active duty. And then you have where the veterans tend to be a little bit older, or maybe they're just younger families, but they're still already left active duty. We will support them in their needs, so depending on what they need.
And out of that service, many find healing.
Then they call it PTSG, PTS growth. So sometimes when you have something traumatic in your life, you can really find some good out of it.
And fair warning, you've heard of brothers in arms. Well, wait till you see mothers in service.
Careful what you ask a Gold Star mom to do, because we can rally and we can be on the front line before you even know what happened. we're pretty strong.
Great organization, the Gold Star Mothers of Washington, and they are our charity of the month. You can find out more at MyNorthwest.com. Thanks for listening to Seattle's Morning News. I'm Dave Ross.
And I'm Colleen O'Brien. Thanks for listening to the show's podcast. We're happy you're here.
And you can keep up with the show and find some of the stories from today online at MyNorthwest.com.